one who had any criticism of Yazid's rulership. And keep in mind, this was someone who was a very public sinner. So the things that they were criticizing or they were opposing were not things that were hearsay. He was publicly drinking. He was publicly gambling. He was being a womanizer. He was very proud of the things that he was doing. And so obviously, a lot of people were seeing major flaws in what was happening and in the way that he was running the affairs of the Ummah. And anyone who had any remote criticism was being persecuted and they were being killed. So the vacuum that you're talking about was one where no one had any freedom to oppose Yazid, even by tongue, at the bare level, the bare minimum level.
Hmm. So it's something that we can all agree on, that the Imam must have thought that Islam was in danger and therefore had to act.
Absolutely, because the government at the time was mainly run by individuals and the personalities that they carried. So when the government in place is being run, it's supposed to be an Islamic government, but you have a person at the highest level that openly commits sins, that openly drinks alcohol, etc., it doesn't set a good example for the rest of the community.
And obviously, when you're saying that Islam was in danger, everything that Yazid was doing was opposing Islam and opposing the traditions of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. So, for a Muslim to have an issue with what Yazid was doing and not be allowed to have an issue clearly puts the Muslims, at risk and in danger.
Mm-hmm. But there's also an argument that's been made that actually Imam Hussein, he didn't go to Kufa to oppose Yazid. He, that wasn't an interest of his at the time. He was simply going to the people of Kufa who had called him, and he was there as a leader, as a religious leader, not as a political leader. Mm-hmm. So did Imam Hussein oppose Yazid?
He definitely opposed Yazid, absolutely. When he was in Mecca, he was getting the viewpoints of various people during the Hajj, and everyone was quite openly, or they were quite dissatisfied with Yazid being the ruler. And the people of Kufa had written letters to him openly stating that they're ready to go to war against Yazid to remove him from the Khalifa. That's how much they had objected to him being the Khalifa. So it was quite open in terms of their opposition towards him. It was at a very high level.
And I think opposition comes in many levels, but we need to keep in mind that Yazid was demanding that Imam Hussein would pledge allegiance to him, and this was not something that Imam Hussein would consider doing or ever do. And that in itself is opposing Yazid.
And 1,400 years later, people are still commemorating. We still remember him, we still go to Majalis, we are still talking about him. Why and how is that the case?
Well, I think just to take it a step back, the Prophet used to cry and mourn for Imam Hussein before the tragedy even took place. So, the Prophet passed away around 50 years before the tragedy of Karbala happened. Mm-hmm. So commemorating Imam Hussein and remembering the events of Ashura is from the Sunnah of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing that needs to be put out there. In terms of, I think you said how and why, it has continued.
Yes. It's so many years now, like why and how are we still in today's modern world still talking about a battle that happened so many years ago?
I mean, let me know what you think, but in my opinion, it's obviously the imams that followed Imam Hussein all had a role in continuing the majalis and the azah and the information. And to take a step back, Sayyidah Zainab herself on the day and afterwards of continuing the message, and after that through the Muslims themselves. But it's my opinion that it is commemorated today and has continued and lasted throughout these years because Allah wants it to continue. And also because it's a message that resonates with everyone. It's not for Muslims or for females or Arabs or any of that. It's a message that really anyone who hears is touched by and can apply to their day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's such a universal message of standing up for your principles, of having absolute trust and confidence in your righteous position and not being an oppressor. That was a very important thing for Imam Hussein. Time and time and during the battle, prior to the battle, even until his last moments of life, he kept giving opportunities to his enemies to engage with him in a righteous manner, in a correct manner, to oppose him properly, and to even change their strategies, change their tactics, change their position to a more correct position, which was it's something that everyone can attest to, because we all have Yazids in our lives, whether on the small scale or the large scale, in terms of governments or individuals or even family members. There's always little acts of oppression, larger acts of oppression. So the message is universal: to stand up against your oppressor, to not tolerate injustice.
Absolutely.
Which is why it resonates with so many people.
And I think it's different to commemorate on a community level, but which is obviously very important, but also we commemorate on a personal level, which leads me to my second question, and I'll start with you, Sirwan. What does Ashura, what does Karbala, the battle, what does it mean to you to commemorate it every year?
There's the famous saying, "Kulli yawmin Ashura, kulli ardhin Karbala." Every day is Ashura, every land is Karbala. Because, just to go back to what we were saying, there's little moments in our lives, perhaps on a day-to-day basis, and the larger events that might take place once in a lifetime, if ever, where we have a choice between right and wrong, justice and injustice. And in terms of what it means to us, it's always to try to apply those lessons that Imam Hussein advocated for, the example that he set, to do as much as possible in terms of living up to that standard. So that's what it means to me in terms of, and we remind ourselves every year, just as we go to Hajj, just as we celebrate Eid, for the sacrifice that Ibrahim had with his son and so forth. It's to try to live up to that example, and it's a reminder every year.
Ahsan.
Because reminders are necessary, of course.
And earlier this week, we spoke to Muslims of all ages here in London about the significance of Imam Hussein's sacrifice on the fields of Karbala. Here's what they had to say.
The story of Karbala is where Islam was reborn again. So after the Prophet had died, it didn't take long for the story of Islam, the real Islam, to, you know, be distorted, and for everyone to stand up and make their own religion and to say, you know, it's from the Prophet, which is happening again nowadays. So what happened was that this had to happen, this Qiyam, this this stand had to happen by only the most truthful of persons who was closest to the Prophet in terms of, you know, akhlaq and everything, to reborn Islam after it had already, you know, kind of faded out.
We commemorate Ashura as it's an event that Islam got built through it, right? We commemorate because he's our role model, he's someone that we should look up to. As Islam is basically a rundown of the narrations and the teachings of these people, such as Imam Hussein and all the people in Karbala, I think so it's important to remember it, because it can help us throughout life.
As a young boy in primary school, Imam Hussein is very important to me because, number one, he is very inspiring. He also fought for Islam till death. And he's carried down his generations, his son, his grandson, till now. He has taught me to be respectful, kind, believe in Islam and Allah, of course.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is significant today because he showed during not just his, of course, his martyrdom and his death, but throughout the course of his life, the importance of being involved in society, the importance of being involved in social issues, and the importance of political and social and environmental and, you know, economic awareness of your surrounding and of your context. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam is somebody who really understood the context of the time in which he lived. And I think we have to take the teachings of Imam al-Hussein and apply them to our day. And by that I mean, you know, we have a living Imam. You know, there are many people who talk about serving Imam al-Hussein. Well, you have a living Imam that you need to remind yourself that you need to serve, Imam al-Hujjah.
Why is Imam Hussein important is a really good question. And the way that I see it is, first of all, Imam Hussein is for humanity, it's for everyone. When you see that he sacrificed himself for justice, he never stood for oppression, because he was against someone who openly was corrupted, you know, and he was never believed in the message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He was doing things that a leader shouldn't have been doing. So therefore he stood against it, and he had no right, he had every right to stand against it. And that's why I think that we look up to, like, we look, us as Shia, we look after him, because we stand for humanity, justice, against oppression, and the freedom, you know. That's the main thing that we all, as a human being, you want freedom, I want freedom. So what a great example Imam Hussein has given us, you know.
Now, Sister Zainab, what does Ashura mean to you? I know you're a mom, mashallah, you're, you know, very active in the community. What does Ashura mean to you? What does the practice of Ashura mean to you?
I think over the years it has meant different things throughout the different phases of my life. It used to be a time, actually it still is, it's Muharram is a month that I crave. It's the spirituality that comes with it, the majalis, the sense of community. All of it is something that, you know, with our very busy, hectic lifestyles, it's so easy to get lost in things that are really not important. And Muharram and the Arba'een recenters me. Listening to the story of Karbala, the messages that we have learned from them, the things that we should be applying to our day-to-day life is definitely like a center point for me throughout my year. But going to the majalis and having the sense of community and seeing how everyone is focused on one goal and commemorating the imam, and you know, and that's shown even more in the Arba'een when you are with people, millions of people from all over the world, from various different countries, all walking in that same direction, the sense of unity that it gives me, I think that's the main thing.
That sense of unity for me actually is mirrored in Hajj, you know, when the adhan goes off and everybody just, you know, uniform.
Absolutely.
Get into like it's yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's exactly what it is. I unfortunately haven't been able to go to Hajj yet, but I do feel that in the Arba'een, where it's, you know, you feel like Sirat al-Mustaqim, and everyone is on this path, walking, and everyone around you who's not walking is helping you in your walk. They want to help you with giving you food, with giving you shelter, with giving you a massage. That sense of unity is unmatched for me, and I crave it, and I miss it. And also knowing that when injustice takes place, what our role and what our duty is, because just like the brother said, we are faced with Yazids in our day-to-day life on whatever scale it is. Knowing that what my duty and what my obligation is, knowing that it can be done, and also knowing that the truth will always prevail, even if I don't see it in my lifetime, is something that gives me a lot of motivation.
Absolutely. And the teachings of Imam Hussein, you know, we have them on a personal level, but you kind of started to talk about how it affects the world stage a little bit. You know, everybody from all walks of life, they come together to walk towards Imam Hussein. But let's actually, if I can recenter the discussion a little bit around the revolutions or the causes that Imam Hussein's message has touched or has provoked reactions, been made a catalyst to. Sirwan, you know, you're a political analyst, you know very much about the region of Iraq, Iran, etc., the Middle East. In your opinion, what has Imam Hussein's message provoked, created as a catalyst in the region in terms of fighting against oppression?
Imam Hussein's message, particularly for Shia Muslims, has always been a symbol, a unifying factor, where they've used that as inspiration for the struggles that they've faced. The Islamic Revolution of 1979 for Iran is a massive example, where it was a very strong echoing of what took place in Karbala, the symbolism, and so forth. The militias in Iraq, since ISIS took over on a more recent time, was a massive influence as well. Hezbollah in 1985, when they were founded, were strongly inspired by Imam Hussein's message, and the symbolism is used in language, in poetry, in flags, in commemorations. It's not just with him as well. It's also a universal message. Mahatma Gandhi took inspiration from Imam Hussein. There's a famous quote that he used that he references Imam Hussein. There's another one from Nelson Mandela, surprisingly, as well. There's Edward Gibbon from the 19th century, when he was writing about the fall of the Holy Roman Empire, referenced the Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein. So it's been inspiration to a whole lot of movements, because it is such an incredible example where most estimates are between 72 to 130 companions on Imam Hussein's side. That's how large his army was, facing an army of anywhere between 1,000 to 30,000 or more, depending on the traditions. And there's been no such example of history of such a certain defeat by one group, and yet there were members of the opposing army that joined the losing side. I personally haven't come across such an example, but it exists in Karbala. It's just such an astonishing message and such an astonishingly inspirational point of view that Imam Hussein was able to convince people to walk into absolute certain death when they were facing quite the opposite at that time, when they were facing absolute victory. So, yeah, it's been a very inspirational message.
I think many people have also, Zainab, for you, I know that Palestine is very, it's a cause that's very dear to your heart, and a lot of people have spoken about today's Karbala being Palestine. Do you agree?
I think the message of Karbala is, because it's so as universal as we've been saying, applies to very large scale issues like the brother mentioned, and also much smaller ones. If we go by the message being that the truth will always be there, and if we go that the oppressor will face what they have coming. Mm. It might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but it's going to come. Mm. And if we believe that, you know, with Allah's justice, and knowing that death does not mean losing. Death, if anything, you know, like it says in the Quran, don't even think of them as dead for martyrs in the fi sabilillah. When we take all these messages on board and we remind ourselves about these things in our day-to-day life, then I think then going back, yes, every single one of the situations that we face now, we have to deal with it with the inspiration that we have received from Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his message.
And I think it's vacant, the discussion that we're having, without actually talking about the Yazid of our time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you know Imam Hussein wouldn't have fought against just anything. You know, there has to be a tyrant, an oppressor. Who is that for us in today's world, do you think?
It's countless on the individual level. You have all the sorts of Yazid in your workplaces, in your schools, whether you're the
we're
children.
We're definitely talking all about a common Yazid for all mankind.
Oh, absolutely. On the large scale, of course, there's the Israeli-Palestine issue. That's a very dear issue, not just to the people sitting here, but to all Muslims. There's, you know, the Uyghurs in China that are facing massive issues against the Chinese government. There's a genocide going on. There is Muslims are suffering under the recent government in India. There are issues in Pakistan with Shia Muslims being killed. There's, without question, hijabis being oppressed in France and, you know, banned from attending schools and workplaces if they wear the hijab. So there's Yazids everywhere, unfortunately, even in our current era. No matter how much we fight, there's always Yazids.
That's very true. It's something that I think most people who commemorate Imam Hussein realize this, and for the majority of the time, it's actually not just Muslims. I think you were kind of hinting at that point, that this isn't, you know, the stories of Imam Hussein and Yazid, it's not limited to Islam or Shia Muslims. Mm-hmm. You know, we all face it. Mm-hmm. Just in summary, do you feel that Imam Hussein's message is universal? Is it an inclusive message?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, first of all, in terms of inclusivity, if you just look at the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that was an army made up, it was a small army, but it was an army made up of people from different backgrounds and different tribes. The first person who comes to my mind is John, you know, mm-hmm. One of the famous companions of Imam Hussein. The message itself has nothing to do with a single tribe or a single person or a single religion. It is about standing up to injustice. It is about acknowledging injustice and trying to spread good. And that's in the words of Imam Hussein himself. When he explains what he is doing, he says that I am trying to revive the message of my grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and spread good and forbid evil. Anyone who sees injustice and remains quiet against it is part of the injustice. Mm. Now, that injustice can be towards Muslims, it could be towards animals, it could be towards absolutely anyone. The message applies to every person in every single day.
Ahsanti. Mm. And Sirwan, is the message of Imam Hussein, is it universal?
Absolutely. You don't need to be a Muslim or a Shia to draw inspiration from it. We were mentioning earlier that all sorts of other political figures that were non-Muslim drew inspiration from the Imam. And just earlier this week, there is a food drive that is done by people here in London, and we were dropping off the massive pot that is donated by an Indian restaurant, and we spoke to the owner as we were dropping it off. Turns out he's a Sikh, and he's read extensively about Islamic history, and to our surprise, we didn't even ask any questions. He straight away told us for 30 minutes about how the message of Imam Hussein resonates with him deeply, and he has referred to it and leaned on it in times of distress. And me and my friend were quite surprised, and subhanAllah.
Absolutely. Great story. Thank you so much for sharing that. Imam Hussein does unite us all. Okay, that's all we have time for today. Thank you to all of our guests, and thank you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
In the limelight.
Today, millions of Americans remain disenfranchised and denied access to the most basic freedoms taken for granted by others, simply because of their race. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out noted, disparities between black and white Americans persist in employment, wages, health care, voting rights, sentencing and incarceration, housing, and the building of intergenerational wealth. Jennifer Jones Austin, executive director of the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies, FPWA, a century-old group with deep ties to the civil rights movement, said, "Racial inequality is still recorded across nearly all measures of well-being in the U.S. today." Today, millions of Americans remain disenfranchised and denied access to the most basic freedoms taken for granted by others simply because of their race. Black Americans earn 20% less than their white counterparts, even with identical college degrees. This racial wealth gap has long-term detrimental impacts on families. One in three black children live in poverty, compared to less than one in 10 white children. On the surface, many of the policies and legal structures that maintain inequality have little to do with the anti-woke culture wars Republicans obsess over, especially now that the likes of DeSantis and Donald Trump have weaponized white backlash to the uprising against systematic racism and police violence that swelled in 2020. The movement for Black Lives harkens back to the 1960s, when images of police brutality in the Deep South fueled civil rights protests, and white conservatives responded to calls for desegregation with racist frenzy and banter about the state's rights. The painting of today's black and intersectional activists as anti-American and the banning of their ideas and identities in the classroom comes right out of an old right-wing playbook, creating a convenient distraction from long-standing pillars of white supremacy. A prime example, jobs and minimum wage, an issue as salient today as it was when black workers marched in 1963 to demand jobs with dignity and fair pay. Adjusted for inflation, today's federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour has less earning power than the $1.25 minimum in 1963. In fact, the minimum wage is worth less today than any time since 1956, thanks to congressional inaction by both Democrats and Republicans. Employment discrimination and underfunded K-12 schools help explain why black workers tend to be concentrated in lower-wage industries, disproportionately exposing black families to the rock-bottom federal wage floor maintained by Congress and red state legislatures. Indeed, black sanitation workers are still organizing for better wages and working conditions decades after the Memphis sanitation strike of 1968. Martin Luther King was assassinated shortly after rallying with the striking workers. Even as black people earn college degrees at significantly higher rates today, on average, they continue to face higher unemployment and lower wages than their white counterparts across all ages and educational levels, according to the report. The average black college graduate owes $25,000 more in student loan debt than their average white counterpart due to lower levels of pay for the same work, which exacerbates the wealth gap. This wealth gap between white and non-white workers remains stubbornly wide as a result, even as the wage parity improved somewhat since 1963. The median annual income among white women with college degree is 19% higher than black women with college degrees. On average, black and brown women earn $0.65 and $0.55 for every $1 earned by white men, respectively. Today, black and Latino men are concentrated in low-wage jobs more than any other group. Then there is racist policing and the U.S. system of mass incarceration, a nexus of discrimination and institutionalized violence that many activists remain committed to abolishing 3 years after 2020 uprisings. This system has been upheld by both Republicans as well as Democrats. According to reports, in most major cities, Democratic leaders ignore widespread calls to divest from police departments and local jails and invest instead in schools, parks, healthcare, and social services to build safety in communities suffering from divestment and targeted law enforcement. As a result, black and Latino men are still disproportionately incarcerated for drugs, and black men without high school diplomas are 3 times more likely to be incarcerated than their white counterparts, according to the reports. For incarceration rates, the disparity is yet more severe. 1 of 3 black boys born today can expect to be sentenced to prison in their lifetime versus 1 out of 17 for their white peers, Jones Austin said, adding, "We need more aggressive policy change." Race and identity may be flashpoints in today's partisan politics in the United States, but the policies that shape racial disparities were supported by leaders in both parties, Democrats and Republicans. From decades of attacks on organized labor and neoliberal trade deals that offshored jobs in 1990s and 2000s, to the disastrous war on drugs and racist sentencing laws that filled prisons with black and brown people, both Democrats and Republicans have supported and upheld the building blocks of systematic racism. Meanwhile, Washington Times reported cities with higher numbers of black residents and more segregated neighborhoods are more likely to have mass shootings due to the effects of structural racism in the United States. And that's according to a new study. 10 researchers published a study recently in JAMA Surgery. They examined 865 mass shootings that killed 828 people and wounded 3,968 across the U.S. 51 largest metro areas from 2015 to 2019, as recorded in population-based data and the Gun Violence Archive. The study found that cities with higher percentages of black residents, higher instances of black-white neighborhood segregation, higher violent crime rates, and more single-parent black families were more likely to be affected by mass shootings, which the researchers defined as incidents that killed or wounded at least four people. The FBI also uses that definition to track the crimes.
Face to face.
Hello and welcome to this special edition. The 23rd of July is the martyrdom anniversary of a well-known Iranian scientist, Dariush Rezai Nejad, who occupies a very special place in the hearts and minds of Iranians. To honor his memory, we are joined by his daughter. Thank you very much for coming to this show.
It was an honor.
Before we start our conversation, let's take a look at the biography of your father.
July 23rd, 12 years ago, motorcycle-borne assailants working for the Israeli spy agency appeared out of nowhere and shot at Dariush Rezai Nejad six times in Tehran in front of his wife and daughter. 35-year-old Rezai Nejad was the fourth Iranian nuclear scientist to be assassinated in a span of 4 years after Ardeshir Hosseinipour on January 15, 2007, Masoud Ali Mohammadi on January 12, 2010, and Majid Shahriari on November 29, 2010. Rezai Nejad's wife Shohreh Pirani chased the terrorists and then realized they were shooting at her as well. She ultimately fell to the ground in a wounded state and saw the motorcycle speeding away. Armita Rezai Nejad, their daughter, was only 4.5 years old at the time. She saw the horror unfold before her eyes. Their small and beautiful world crashed down with 6 bullets. But she was too little to understand the magnitude of the tragedy. Armita is 16 now and has grown into a thoughtful young woman with remarkable confidence, composure, and poise.
Welcome back. So, 12 years ago, you were very young, and your father was assassinated before your very eyes. Do you remember anything on that day?
Well, it's not something that you can forget easily, even as a child, I guess. It was really terrifying, and I was so confused. After a while, I started to understand what was happening, and it was really hard to believe, but I kind of got along with the whole thing that happened.
I really don't want to make you relive those moments, but at that time, how aware were you of what exactly had happened?
Well, at first, I didn't see what was happening because I had dropped my doll under my father's seat, and I bent over to take it, and then I came up with the sound of the bullets. The first thing that I noticed was a man, I guess, his face is really black for me. I like he was wearing a mask, but he wasn't. And I saw the gun. And then after that, he ran away. I turned to my father. He was laying on the seats of the car, and there was blood everywhere. Well, as a child, I obviously didn't know that he was dead, but I knew that something bad had happened, so I started screaming and calling him over and over, but he wouldn't answer. And that made me worried, and I was really stressed, and I kept screaming and crying, but there was no answer from him.
When did you come to realize that you had actually lost your father, and how did you feel?
Well, I don't quite remember that, but the thing that has happened is that someone seemed to be telling me that okay, your father is gone forever, and he's never gonna return. I think it was a big shock for a 4-year-old kid. So, as my mother says, I kind of exploded and started screaming and crying. And even when I think of it right now, I remember that it must have been really shocking, because as a child, I didn't know what death was. And it was really, I was really afraid of what is coming. But then I forgot what happened because, you know, I think you need to be a grown-up to understand the loss, and I understand it now, but at that time, no.
It must have been very difficult for you.
We could say, yes.
And, of course, daughters and fathers have a very strong bond, usually. And I would like to know more about that bond between you and your dad. How close were you? What are some of the memories that you have?
Well, I don't remember a lot right now. But when I think about it, I only remember the love he had for me. And he was always so specific about my health. And he would always say, for example, "Wear on your sunglasses." I didn't want to do that because it's really hard. And he always made me do that because the doctor had told me I should wear sunglasses because of my eyes. He took care of me like when you want to take care of something really precious. You care about every detail. I think he was like that about me, and his support was this way.
So you must have felt an empty space after you lost your father.
Of course. You know, every person feels that, you know, every loss in someone's life. When you lose a person, there would be an empty space in your life. And, well, a father for a child would be much bigger empty space. I feel it now. And even back then, I always felt that.
Exactly. And you've grown into a young lady, and we're very proud to have you here with us today. So I do know that particularly for teenagers, it's a very specific time in your life. And in many cases, you need to talk to your parents. The fact that you don't have your father with you to consult with him, how does that feel?
At first, I have to say that we believe that martyrs can hear us. And whenever I'm in a really big problem in my life, I always ask for help. And he answered me multiple times. I've seen it not like a conversation or something, but he had made things correct the way that they, I wanted them to be, and I believe he can hear me now. From that part, it's not like I've lost him like that. He is here with me, not physically, but I can feel him beside me every day and every minute of my life, especially in hard times.
Well, that is great. You know that your father is a hero to millions of Iranians. He is much revered. He occupies a very special place for us. What does it feel like to be the daughter of such an iconic man?
I'm really proud of him. And when I think about what he has done, what he has accomplished, I think like, oh my God, I'm daughter of such a know, how should I say it? You know, I don't know how to define it, but if I want to define it in teenage language, such a cool person, and he'd done a lot of great things for his country, for our country, and I wish to be like him one day. I want to do what he did. I want to accomplish things like what he accomplished.
And today your face is familiar for many Iranians. You attend a lot of seminars to talk about your father and his legacy. How do you do that?
If I want to say the truth, my mother is a really big part of this. She always pushes me and she says, okay, you should do this. She challenges me. And I honor that, and she does it really good way, and it's it benefits me, and I get the confidence and courage from her. It's not mine. I'm not that brave, but she's really, she likes me to do this, and she makes me do this.
Well, it's great that you have your mother's support, but I believe you're underestimating yourself as well.
I don't know, but that's what I think, actually. And yeah, but my mother has been always a big part of my life and a great supporter of me.
And how close are you with your mom? Do you believe that your mom has been able to fill that empty space that your father has left behind?
Well, my mother is a great mother, and I think I can't say that she could fill the empty space of a father, because, you know, fathers have their own roles in a child's life. But I think as a mother who didn't have her husband beside her, she's done real great, and what she did is really great, and I think not anyone can do what she did with me, with our life. She's a true hero, I guess. What she had been able to handle all these years, 12 years alone, that's really impossible. I think I wouldn't be able to do that if I was in her situation. She's really strong, and I've never seen anyone like her.
So was she a role model to you?
Yes. I mean, in a lot of ways, she's a perfect woman in her life. And I think every woman needs to learn from her, and she is taught to listen to every woman, that especially the people who have the same conditions as us. She's a great role model. You know, what she does affects people, I think, in a good way, and we all need to learn from her.
And you're absolutely right when you describe her as a strong woman. I totally agree. Where do you think she gets her strength?
I don't know exactly, but at first, her belief in God, because if someone believes in God, they become really stronger. And then her belief in the fact that my father is here and he can hear us. I think these two had made her so strong. And her personality is obviously really important. She has been a strong woman ever since she was born and a bit stubborn, but I guess that's what makes her so strong.
Well, recently you gave a lesson in nuclear diplomacy to the UN nuclear agency chief during his visit to Tehran with a powerful speech that grabbed headlines.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. I am Amita Rezaei-Nejad, daughter of one of the Iranian nuclear martyrs. I welcome your presence in Iran. We are in the eve of a new year. I had a normal life 11 years ago, but 6 bullets ended that life. I was 4 and a half when my father was assassinated in front of my eyes. He was a scientist who had nothing to do with violence, and I am not the only one. But that's only a part of the story. Today, many patients lose their lives for the reason of receiving no medicine. Many people are crushed by the bad economic situation caused by the sanctions. The nation of Iran expects you to help us to improve our current state by giving impartial and fair reports about Iran's peaceful nuclear activities. Thank you.
How did you do that?
At first, my mother again. But then, at first I didn't want to do that. And I thought, okay, it's really scary to stand up there and hold people staring at you and you have to speak in English. I'm not a native speaker of English. But then I realized that if I want the world to hear me, I should do that. It's really important. And my mother pushed me and she said that you should do that. And that's the way it happened. I wasn't really prepared. I just started writing something really quick. And I hadn't even checked it with my mom. And she was like, okay, show it to me. And I said, no, I want to be what I be. I want it to be what I want it to be. And I went up there and said everything that I should have said.
So you just poured your heart out.
I guess we can say it was like that. Yeah.
There's also a viral video clip of you meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And you seem emotional in that video. Tell us more about that.
I had been waiting for that for a really long time. I mean, after the pandemic, we hadn't met him. I hadn't met him, and I was really waiting for this day to come. And I even cried over it once before that because I couldn't see him. I had cried a lot. And then, when it happened, it was a shock. It was a shock and a surprise to me. We didn't expect that, and I was really emotional. I couldn't control my myself, my hands, and my voice. Yeah, I think it's pretty clear. And that's it.
What does that visit mean to you?
A lot. It's nothing you can explain like in words. It can only be heard by the sound of heart, which I'm not really ready to do this. But yes, I had really strong emotions at that time.
You sure did, and it was pretty obvious. So your father was martyred for a cause, and that's what martyrdom is all about. That is sacrificing your life for the greater good, if you will. And that's what your father did. And Iranians owe a lot to him. All of us, we owe a lot to him. As a young Iranian citizen and the daughter of this person, what kind of responsibility do you think you have?
Well, I think that every one of us, as an Iranian, we should try our best to continue what he had done. We should try to improve our country in a good way. We should try to go in a way that develop our country into make it better and better each day. With what we do, whatever we do, it's not important. We shouldn't just be in nuclear industry or something. Whatever you do, you should do it the best way that you can, so it'll help your people, the people of your country. I think that's the responsibility that everyone has.
And, of course, your father was active in the most important, probably, we can say, the most important scientific field, which is nuclear technology for peaceful purposes, of course, and that is what Iran has been doing over the past years. And Iran has made great achievements despite having to pay the price for it with martyrs like your dad. We have been able to make great achievements in the field of nuclear medicine and other peaceful applications of nuclear energy, such as agriculture. Do you know anything about this, and how proud of you of these achievements? And you were among the people who had to pay a hefty price for these achievements as well.
Yes, of course, I do know. I can't say I do know a lot, but I think it's really, really great that we're having this progress, and I think we can achieve even more in the future. Something that helps people, something that saves their lives, is really, really great and good. And I think the price I paid, my family paid, worths it for this progress to be made.
So you did describe your mom as a very strong woman and someone that has played a pivotal role in your life. Is there anything you want to tell her?
Well, I love you at first, and thank you for supporting me in all phases of my life. If she wasn't beside me, I wouldn't be able to do a lot of things that I had done, and I wouldn't, I'm a bit, no, kind of lazy, and she always pushes me and supports me in everything. I can't imagine a life without her. I mean, that would be terrific. The thought of, the think of losing her terrifies me deep down.
So what do you have to say for teenagers, people your age in Iran? How can they make the best of the opportunities that life brings them?
Well, the thing that I would like to say, I really love astronomy. As we know right now, the world is really, really big, and so big that we can't see a part of it. It's so far away that the light didn't have enough time to get to us. And in this really big and vast world that we have, the universe, Earth is just a tiny, small dust, even smaller than that, I'm really. But in the same time, on Earth, which is really, really small, some people will kill, some people would destroy lives to get only a small part of this tiny, tiny Earth. And even if they take over the Earth completely, they still don't own anything. It's like they don't own anything. So what I think is, when we want to do something, whatever it is, we should, for just a moment, think about what effects will it have, and is it worth it? Can I break a heart? Does it worth it? I mean, in this whole big universe, is it that important?
And of course, I believe this is the core message of what you told Rafael Grossi, the IAEA chief, the crippling sanctions and how they've hurt particularly sick children in Iran. That's basically what you wanted to say, wasn't it?
Yes. I think I should have said things that I said right now, but I didn't have them in mind. Our decisions might affect one person and maybe thousands of people. And we should be really careful of what we do, especially when we are in high authorities. We should be really, really careful of what we do.
How strongly do you feel about this?
Really strong. Sometimes when I think about it, it makes me cry because one of our relatives has recently been diagnosed with cancer, and his medicines couldn't be found, and he's really having a really hard time, and he's in a lot of pain, and when I see him suffering, it really makes me want to cry, because he was really close to me, and his daughter is my friend, and when I see their pain, it's like it's my pain, and I'm really frustrated about it, that I can't do anything, but I want to take even the smallest step in this way.
So you want to leave a mark in this world?
Yes. If it's if it has an effect, why not, even the tiniest effect? It's really important, I think, that if every one of us take a step, then it might be even millions of miles if every one of us do something.
Well, you know that your story inspires a lot of people, and that is probably why it was even the topic of a movie called Henos. Have you seen that movie?
Several times. Maybe 10 times even.
So tell us about this movie. How close is it in portraying the reality?
As my mother says, movies are movies. They mixed reality with some things that are not real, so it could be attractive. But all in all, I was a little child back then, but as my mother says, everything in that movie contains a part of reality that has happened in our life. So I guess it explains the way things were really good, in a good way, and it does have effect on the people who are watching it in a good way.
So you do recommend that?
Yes, sure, of course.
Well, it was very nice talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us on this show.
It was an honor, and I'm really happy to be here.
Well, that's it, all the time that we have for this special edition.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.